A strategic power means what's called critical leverage over industrial rivals. That's Zbigniew Brzezinski's observation recently, referring to the hoped-for benefits of the invasion of Iraq. That outcome is Washington's ultimate nightmare, almost. Could get worse. It's not unlikely that an independent bloc of this kind might develop major energy projects jointly with China and India, perhaps even allying with the Asian Energy Security Grid and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Those are based in China and Russia, perhaps will incorporate India, which has been developing joint projects with China aimed at Asian integration and independence. Bush's visit to India the last couple of days is one of the many efforts to impede these clear tendencies, which are likely to continue anyway. And it's likely, almost certain, that South Korea and the Southeast Asian countries will also join Japan's kind of uncertain, but it might. Well, the prospect that Europe and Asia might move towards greater independence has seriously troubled U.S. planners ever since World War II. And those concerns have considerably increased in the last several decades as what's called the tripolar world has continued to evolve. Three major centers, North America, Europe, mainly Northeast Asia. In addition, now there are, for the first time, quite important South-South interactions, mainly Brazil, South Africa, and India. And there's also rapidly growing European Union engagement with China, which are perhaps now or very soon each other's largest trading partners. Well, loss of the critical leverage would be a serious blow to plans for global dominance that trace right back to the beginning of World War II. U.S. intelligence has projected that the United States would control Middle East oil for the traditional reasons, but that the United States itself would rely mainly on what are called more stable Atlantic Basin resources. That means West Africa and the Western Hemisphere. Control of Middle East oil is now far from a sure thing, and these expectations are also threatened by very important developments in the Western Hemisphere, which in fact are being accelerated by Bush administration's policies, which have left the United States remarkably isolated in the global arena. The Bush administration even succeeded in alienating Canada, and that's a really impressive feat. Takes genius to do that. The reason is Washington's brazen rejection of NAFTA decisions favoring Canada. U.S. government just told them to get lost. Well, that may accelerate establishment of closer Canada-China relations. In fact, that's what Canadian officials have been saying in reaction. Canadian officials have said that Canada may shift a significant portion of its trade, particularly oil exports, from the United States to China. In a further blow to Washington's energy policies, the leading oil exporter in the hemisphere, Venezuela, has forged probably the closest relations with China of any Latin American country and is planning to sell increasing amounts of oil to China. That's part of its effort to reduce its dependence on the very hostile, openly hostile U.S. government. In fact, Latin America as a whole is increasing trade and other relations with China. There are some setbacks, but likely expansion. That's particularly true for the major raw material exporters, Brazil and Chile. Meanwhile, for the first time since the Spanish conquest, Latin America is moving towards closer integration, independent of Washington. Venezuela just joined the South American Customs Union, Mercosur. That's a move described by Argentine President Kirchner as a milestone in the development of this trading bloc. It's welcomed as opening a new chapter in our integration by Brazilian President Lula da Silva. There was a meeting in Uruguay convened to mark Venezuela's formal entry into Mercosur. Venezuelan President Chavez said that we cannot allow this to be purely an economic project, one for the elites and for the transnational companies. That's a not very oblique reference to the U.S.-sponsored free trade agreement for the Americas, which is highly unpopular in Latin America. Venezuela also supplied Argentina with oil to help starve off an energy crisis, and it bought part of Argentina's debt. That's one element of a very important region-wide effort to free the countries from the controls of the IMF after two decades of disastrous effects of conformity to the rules imposed by the U.S.-dominated international financial institutions. The IMF has acted towards our country as a promoter and vehicle of policies that caused poverty and pain among the Argentine people, President Kirchner said in announcing his decision to pay almost $1 trillion to rid itself of the IMF forever with the help of Venezuela. Radically violating IMF rules, Argentina did enjoy a substantial economic recovery from the disaster left by IMF policies. Well, steps towards regional integration advanced further with the election of Evo Morales last December as the first president coming from the indigenous majority. And Morales moved quickly to reach a series of energy accords with Venezuela. Its gas reserves are second only to Venezuela's in South America. And Morales, too, committed himself to reversing the neoliberal policies that Bolivia had pursued rigorously for 25 years, leaving the country with a lower per capita income than at the outset. Much of the region from Venezuela to Argentina has left-center governments. The indigenous populations have, for the first time, become very active and influential, particularly in Bolivia and Ecuador, both major energy producers, where they either want oil and gas to be domestically controlled or, in some cases, oppose production altogether. Many indigenous people apparently don't see any reason why their lives and societies and cultures should be disrupted or destroyed so that New Yorkers can sit in their SUVs and traffic jams. In fact, some are even calling for an Indian nation in South America. This internal economic integration that's underway is reversing patterns that trace right back to the Spanish conquest. Ever since then, Latin American elites and economies have been linked to the imperial powers, but not to one another. And Washington's traditional mechanisms of control, namely violence and economic strangulation, they're losing their effectiveness. For many reasons, the system of global dominance is fragile, even apart from the damage that's being inflicted on it by Bush planners. Well, looking back over the actual record of policy, extricating itself from the rhetorical frame, we find that the guiding principles are clear and simple enough. Abroad, democracy's fine, but only when it takes a form that does not risk popular interference with the primary interests of power and wealth. And at home, much the same doctrine prevails. Well, no time to go into that critical matter, but I'd like to end with just a couple of words about the topic because it provides some useful and simple ideas as to how to approach and deal with the very grave problems that confront all of us. So here are a couple of suggestions. First, accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court and the World Court. Second, accept the Kyoto Protocols and carry them forward. Third, and very important, let the UN take the lead in international crises. Fourth, rely on diplomatic and economic measures rather than military ones in confronting the grave threats of terror. 5, keep to the conventional interpretation of the UN Charter, meaning the use of force is legitimate only when ordered by the Security Council or when the country is under imminent threat of attack until the Security Council can act. 6, give up the veto at the Security Council and have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, as the Declaration of Independence advises, even if power centers disagree. 7, cut back sharply on military spending and sharply increase social spending, meaning health, education, renewable energy, and so on. Well, these are actually very conservative suggestions for quite a simple reason. They're the opinions of the majority of the population. In almost all cases, the overwhelming majority of the population. The overwhelming majority also wants to rescind Bush's tax cuts for anyone with incomes over $200,000, which means practically all of them. In all these cases, and there are plenty of others, public opinion is in radical opposition to public policy, and both political parties are well to the right of the general population. Well, few people are even aware of these facts, for a simple reason. The regular in-depth public opinion studies by the most prestigious institutions are scarcely reported or not reported at all. When they reveal such facts as these, as they regularly do, that record's highly instructive. Well, these are far from the only constructive suggestions one can think of, but they're a pretty good start. There are also some simple truths that can be quite useful. One of them is to take democracy seriously, and others to pay attention to fact and elementary moral principles. Another is to refuse to accept the self-serving contention of the powerful that what happened in the past can be forgotten because we've undergone a miraculous change of course, something which happens every few years, is very easily demonstrated, and other simple truths. They don't answer every problem by any means, but they do carry us a long way towards developing more specific and detailed answers, as is constantly done, and more important, they open the way to implementing them. These are opportunities that are readily within our grasp in a society that's as free as ours. If we can free ourselves from the shackles of doctrine and illusion. Thank you.
You're listening to Professor Noam Chomsky speaking in Binghamton, New York last weekend. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. We conclude with questions from the audience.
Hi. Thank you very much for what you've chosen to do with your life. And my question is, in a few words, what do you find hopeful?
Hopeful?
Yeah.
I think one should be really optimistic for exactly the reasons I mentioned in the last 2 or 3 minutes. The large majority of the population already agrees with a lot of the things that activists are committed to, so you don't have to convince them. All that's required is to overcome the democratic deficit, that is to organize people who are already convinced. These are not the only. I mean, what I mentioned is a small sample. It's quite an interesting list, and I presume that's the reason why the results of the studies are kept secret. It's a bad idea to let people know that, you know, your neighbors think the same way you do. If you think I'm the only lunatic who has these ideas because everything I read in the press says the opposite, then you keep quiet. It's also, I presume, the reason why elections are very consciously evacuated of content. As I mentioned, I think in the last election, 2004, only about 10% of voters even knew what the stand of the candidates was on issues. And that's done very carefully and explicitly. If any of you, I'm sure you paid attention to the elections. The elections are run, in the elections, candidates are treated as commodities. They're packaged and marketed by the same institutions, public relations industry, the same institutions that packages and markets other commodities, toothpaste, cars, lifestyle drugs, and so on. You may learn in economics courses that we have a wonderful free market based on informed consumers making rational choices and all kind of nice theories about that. But business despises the concept of free markets, spends hundreds of billions of dollars a year to prevent that outcome. And what's more, you all know it. Even the people answering the questions the right way in the economics courses, you know it can't be true. Anyone who's looked at a television ad knows that you're not being helped to become a rational consumer making informed choices. You're helped to become an irrational consumer making uninformed choices. You don't learn anything about the commodity from the television ad. You're subjected to delusion. You know? And furthermore, it's kind of pointless even to say this because it's a truism that everybody knows, you know, down to my grandchildren. You don't get information from an ad about the product. It's the last place to look for information. You're subjected to imagery, deceit, delusion, you know what it's like. And it's the same thing is done when candidates are packaged and sold. Last thing you want to know, what the population to know is what their stand is on issues. This population mostly opposes their stand on issues. They better be kept out of it. You want to keep the population out of the public arena, use the same techniques. Delusion, imagery, exactly what you see if you bother watching a campaign. So you have to keep, but I think that's a very hopeful sign. It's not a reason for pessimism. There's just no reason at all why the United States can't be, say, as democratic as the poorest country in South America. Just take a look at the last election in Bolivia, poorest country in South America. I mean, they had an actual democratic election, which is something we can't even imagine here. I mean, here we have a choice between two commodities. Two wealthy, privileged men, went to the same... we all know it. Know the whole story. Went to the same elite university, joined the same secret society where you're trained to be a member of the ruling class. You're able to run because you have pretty much the same programs and you're supported, funded by pretty much the same concentrations of private capital. And there's a little few differences, but a narrow spectrum. And you're not given a choice between issues. In the poorest country of South America, they were able to elect a candidate from their own ranks. Everybody knew what the issues were. They were clear and important ones, and people voted for them. And they weren't manipulated by huge private institutions that are committed to imagery and deceit. Well, that's more or less democratic election. I mean, it's utterly scandalous that in the richest, most powerful, most free country in the world, we can't even dream of the kind of elections that take place in the poorest countries. That's not a hard thing to perceive or, in fact, to do something about. It's ridiculous to say that we can't do what Bolivian peasants can do. So that's hopeful, but it means doing something about it. It's not going to happen by itself.
Hi, Professor Chomsky. I had a question to follow up on your comments about the exit strategy from Iraq. Last week, we had a talk at Cornell given by... Ambassador Lakhdar Brahimi, who was the former Undersecretary for the United Nations and also the Minister of Foreign Affairs for Algeria. And his talk was essentially talking about the crisis in Iraq. And in a nutshell, he basically described that essentially you have utter chaos in Iraq. And he felt just short of actually proposing a solution. He was actually there to help form, because he was a UN envoy to Iraq to form the Alawi government. And what he essentially said was that if the United States were to withdraw immediately from Iraq, it would essentially put the country even in further chaos. So I wanted you to reflect upon that, and I know you fell short of actually talking about an exit strategy per se, but if you have any comments on his views and your own views on that matter. Thank you.
Well, let me just repeat what I said before. There is no point even talking about an exit strategy unless we're willing to face the fact that the U.S. will do just about anything to prevent a sovereign and more or less democratic Iraq for good, obvious reasons. I mean, unless we recognize that, we can't even talk rationally about the topic. And we're not permitted to recognize that, because that would break a firm taboo. Now, there's an unpronounceable three-letter word that you're not allowed to say if you're in the United States or Britain or Europe. I'll just spell it because it's too bad a word, O-I-L. You're not allowed to say it. You're supposed to think and believe that Bush and Blair would have liberated Iraq even if its exports were lettuce and pickles and the main energy resource of the world were in South Pacific. Unless you believe that, you're not even allowed into the discussion. You're a conspiracy theorist or something. And among the victims, there's just no question. I mean, yes, of course, they all understand it. We know that from polls taken in Iraq. So, for example, right after the president announced his glorious messianic mission to bring democracy to Iraq, there was a Gallup poll in Iraq published in which people were given the opportunity to express their belief in why the U.S. invaded. 1% agreed with 100% of Western opinion. We have to follow the dear leader. So, democracy and so on, because he says so. 1% of, it was in Baghdad, of people in Baghdad agreed. 5% said the purpose was to help Iraqis, and everyone else was a conspiracy theorist, as they're called. I said, obviously take control of Iraq's resources, which are enormous, extend control over the region, and so on. We're not allowed to say that. All right, if we are allowed to say it, if we break the taboo, we can see right away why any form of democracy and certainly sovereignty is just a nightmare for Washington planners. I mentioned some of the reasons, but they're pretty obvious. Unless we are willing to enter the world of rational discussion, there's no point talking about anything else. So if we're willing to go that far, we can then raise the question of what would be an exit strategy. Well, the first part of it, and the most crucial part, would be to overcome the enormous pressure in Washington and Britain, with the support of Europe, the rich countries, not to permit it for these reasons. That's an internal problem in the West, and that's the prime problem. Well, okay, if we can deal with that one, we can then turn to what would be good for Iraqis. And here there's a very elementary principle. We can debate about how it should, what it implies, but at least we should accept the principle. Invading armies have no rights whatsoever. They only have responsibilities. The responsibility is, first of all, to compensate for the enormous damage they inevitably do. And in that case, that means for Britain and the United States, and in fact others, to pay massive reparations to Iraq, and not just for the not aid, reparations, like defeated countries are forced to pay. Reparation is not only the war and the aftermath, which is horrible enough, but a decade of sanctions, U.S., U.K. sanctions, called U.N. sanctions, but everybody knows that nobody wanted them except the U.S. and Britain. So the sanctions just devastated the society, strengthened Saddam, probably kept them in power. So you got to pay for that, for supporting for the war. There's a lot of responsibilities. So that's next. And the next thing to do is just do what the population wants. It's up to them. It's not up to us. It's up to the population to decide what's the right next step. Not up to me, not Mr. Brahimi, nice man, but it's not up to him. It's up to the people of Iraq. Well, you know, we know pretty well what they want. I could find out more. According to British and U.S. polls, about 80% want a strict timetable for withdrawal. Nobody thinks you can withdraw in 1 second, but want a strict timetable for withdrawal. Almost half are in favor of attacks against occupying forces. That's all of Iraq. If you look at Arab Iraq, where the forces actually are, numbers are much higher. Well, okay, you know, it's up to them to figure out what they want the occupying armies to do as best they can, you know, without our interference, without our effort to subvert the outcome, like putting Mr. Alawi in power. Okay, that wasn't an Iraqi decision. In fact, the Iraqis were strong, which you mentioned. That was a Western, a U.S.-British decision. We know how Iraqis felt about it, because over the strong opposition of the U.S. and Britain, they were able to have elections. And in the elections, the favored U.S.-British candidate, Alawi, was given every imaginable advantage, you know, state resources, support of the occupying forces, the only person with access to television and so on. In fact, the U.S., to help out even more, drove the independent press media out of Iraq. That's very important. Can't have a free press in a country if you're going to have free elections. Well, they drove out Al Jazeera because they're one of the major democratizing forces in the Arab world. That's why they're hated by the tyrants who run the oil resources and by the United States, which wants to destroy it. And they were kicked out after their stations were bombed and a journalist killed. So Alawi had every advantage. He got around 13% of the vote. Okay, tells you how popular he is. But it's not our choice. It's their choice. However it works, you know. I mean, we may not like it. They may not be in a great position to have elections. But, you know, we really can't talk about that. We barely have elections at all. If we're worried about, maybe we should send Bolivia there, you know, to teach them how to run elections or something like that. But anyway, it's up to them. So that's the principle. Okay, then you could debate how the principle gets implemented, heeding the voices of the people who have the right to make a decision. But that's as far as the rights of an occupying army can go. The rest you can talk about in academic seminars, but it doesn't have anything to do with policy or shouldn't.
Thank you very much, Dr. Chomsky. I had a question, actually it's two parts. First part, what do you see the probability of Israel or United States using military force or even invading Iran? My second part is, do you see Iraq becoming a theocracy similar to Iran in the future?
Well, you know, if you'd asked me, actually, I wrote about this about a year ago, and at that time I thought the probability of the U.S. Bombing Iran, and if Iran, Israel bombs, that means it's the U.S. doing it. Israel can go just as far as the U.S. lets them. I thought the probability was very low. And now, frankly, I'm not so sure. The Bush administration and its those who support it, the Spear carrier in England, actually most of Europe, they don't say so. They amount to a very dangerous predator, extremely dangerous. And the only thing more dangerous than a violent predator is a wounded predator. So, you know, tiger's bad enough. It's on the loose. It's wounded. It's worse. And they're very severely wounded. So it's kind of hard to say what they're going to do. I mean, it could be that they'll decide just to give up on the hope of any sensible solution and just try to hit the whole system with a sledgehammer and see what happens, you know. Well, you know, what happens could be horrendous, but, maybe they'll be desperate enough to take a chance. I still doubt it, but it's possible. But I really don't think there's much point speculating about the probability. What's important is to prevent it, okay? And we know how to prevent it. I mean, I mentioned a whole lot of ways to prevent it. They're all within our power to implement, every single one, beginning with getting people to be aware of what the facts are. What was the EU-Iran bargain? Why is it that only one country in the world accepts the necessary proposals to end the production of materials for nuclear weapons, which will do us all in. Okay, why must we continue 50 years of torture of the Iranian people? I mean, all of that stuff is within our grasp to do something about, and that's a lot more important than speculating about what people out of our control might do. They're not out of our control unless we want them to be. So as for that, I don't see much point in the speculation. Now, I meanwhile forgot the second part of the question, which was
you see Iraq becoming a theocracy?
Oh, theocracy. Well, we're certainly driving it in that direction. Actually, that was going on through the 1980s and 90s. I mean, when you make people desperate enough, they're very likely to turn to religious extremism, just, you know, as a way of somehow gaining some solace and interaction in the world community, and that's what happened. One of the major effects of these really vicious sanctions, which, remember, killed hundreds of thousands of people and just destroyed the society, and they were strongly opposed by Iraqi dissidents and by Westerners who knew Iraq best, but which is why they were kept out of the media here. You didn't read Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck in the U.S. press because they knew too much. They were the people directing the oil for food program. They had hundreds of investigators all over Iraq. They knew more than any Westerner. And they were, like Iraqi dissidents, bitterly opposed to the sanctions. They all argued that unless the U.S. allows some kind of society to reconstruct, there's no way for them to throw out the tyrant. If it reconstructs, they can probably send them in the same direction as the other tyrants, many of them equal to Saddam, who the U.S. supported right to the end, and Britain, and who were overthrown from within. There's a long string of them. Ceausescu, Suharto, and Marcos, Duvalier, you know, get a long list. Chun in South Korea, you know. Yeah, they were overthrown from within when some kind of society could sustain itself. That's why Halliday resigned in 1998, saying that the sanctions are genocidal, and why von Sponeck resigned 2 years later, same thing. And they're very respected international bureaucrats, diplomats, which is why I presume they were blanked out of the U.S. media. They knew too much, just as Iraqi dissidents were, except the selected group, you know, picked up by the neocons. You know how good their knowledge of Iraq was. One of the effects of the sanctions was to increase religious fundamentalist commitments. That's pretty natural to be expected. The invasion and the war have accelerated these tendencies strongly. And by now, there's always been conflicts in the society, like every society, but nothing like today. You take a look over Iraqi history, it's nothing like today. That's after the invasion and a consequence of the invasion. We might remember a small event called the Nuremberg Tribunals, in which Nazi war criminals were hanged. And the worst crime that they were hanged for was what the tribunal called the supreme international crime, which encompasses within it all the evil that follows. Okay? All the evil that follows. That crime is aggression. So everything that follows from the aggression, including Abu Ghraib, the so-called insurgency, the resistance, you know, the blowing up of Samarra Mosque, whatever happens, you know, that's encompassed in the supreme international crime. And that's what the Nazi war criminals were hanged for. And the American chief counsel, Justice Jackson, made some very eloquent and I think very sincere statements saying that this judgment must apply universally. It must apply to us. He said, we're handing these criminals a poison chalice, and we're going to have to drink from it too if we're guilty. Okay, that's something else that's up to us. One of the things, to the extent that religiously based conflict is developing, and it surely is, yeah, that's part of the evil encompassed in the supreme international crime. So sure, it's visibly happening. I don't see much point speculating on how far it's going to go. much more important, like infinitely more important, is doing what we can to stop contributing to it.
I want to ask you a question about American complicity in sort of funding and training Muslim militants, specifically in the context of education. And there's been a lot of speculation after 9/11 that failed schools, madrasas, religious schools in Muslim countries are sort of incubating terrorism and things like that. But I wanted to actually ask you the question in terms of Professor Mahmoud Mamdani writes in his book, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim. He gives an example of the University of Nebraska that got an American government grant to write to produce textbooks for Afghani children. And there's actually one example he gives them that's very sort of peculiar in that the University of Nebraska Education Department was writing textbooks about math problems in which they were asking children to put themselves in the situation of an Afghani mujahid who's either a terrorist or holy warrior, depending on your perspective, being ambushed by a group of Russian soldiers, and he proceeds to kill four Russians out of 11. So the question asks is how many Russians are left? And so I wanted to ask you in sort of, you know, what do we make of this, that our government's funding you know, these projects and sending these things over there that's sort of incubating its own form of militarism?
Well, this is, did you say Mahmoud Mamdani?
Yeah, Mahmoud Mamdani.
He knows what he's talking about, and that's a good book. He really knows the subject, so, you know, I'm sure what he said is accurate. But the major contribution that the U.S. made to religious fanaticism and extremism in the schools was what I alluded to. A lot of it is coming straight out of the Pakistani madrasas.
Mm-hmm.
Who was establishing them? Well, the dictator that we were supporting. We were supporting him, U.S., the Reagan administration, the guys now in office, were supporting Zia-ul-Huq as he was dismantling the Pakistani educational system, replacing it with a system of madrasas, which are actually a kind of a mixed bag, but the ones that you're referring to and that are having a dangerous effect, we're simply training people in religious extremism. Meanwhile, as I said, the same guys in Washington were pretending that Pakistan isn't producing nuclear weapons, though they knew it was, and so on. A good friend of mine who's a leading nuclear physicist in Pakistani, who one of the leading peace activists there too, an anti-nuclear activist, described to me what he's been teaching physics in one of the universities for, I don't know, 20 or 30 years. He says, you know, they used to have a pretty high level of incoming students. And now, he says, the incoming students, just a large number of them, just don't have the beginning of the preparation for taking science courses, or for that matter, any courses, and furthermore, are indoctrinated believe that it's worthless, you know, like trying to teach biology to somebody who went through the school system in Kansas or something. You know, you're not going to be able to do it. He's written about it, which is pretty courageous in Pakistan. It's not like here, you're taking real chances when you try to tell the truth. And this is going on. And yeah, we played a major role in it. That's another thing we ought to be paying reparations for and trying to reverse somehow. A lot of it was Saudi funding. Remember, Saudi Arabia is the most extreme fundamentalist Islamic state, the worst tyranny in the Arab world. Our U.S. ally, you know, from its origins, close U.S. ally as it is today. And yeah, the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and especially in the 80s, made an enormous contribution to this, just as it essentially organized the extremist Islamic terrorist groups. You know, it's where Osama bin Laden comes from and the rest of them. Yeah, major contribution. Yes, sure, it's really happening. We've got a huge responsibility for it, and there's a lot we could do to try to help reverse it. But again, you got to do it. You know, it's not going to happen by itself.
Thank you.
Professor Chomsky, I want to thank you as a fellow academic and also an organizer for giving us a great organizing opportunity in this space. And I have a comment and a question. The comment has to do with one group of people that's in this audience, which is a lot of leaders and followers of a huge local progressive movement that have made great gains over the last year or so. The other is the undergraduates. Briefly, in the last year, we've seen the growth of a progressive media center, an independent media center here, and you can see the bridge, 5,000 copies, which is out here floating around. This organization has been a backbone of progressive communications, and it leads to the second thing, which Marianne Grady behind me will mention and ask you about in two questions, which is that the St. Patrick's Four here really shone a spotlight on the problems with justice and dealing with the issues you raised in connection with Justice Jackson. And hundreds of people for a week attended a tribunal outside the proceedings of the trial where these four nonviolent activists were being tried for a rather minor crime, for trying to stop a rather major one. At the same time, progressive labor leaders have now moved to the head of the local AFL-CIO Federation. And last but not least, we've elected a very progressive mayor to the city of Binghamton. Now, that said, yeah, oh, he's standing in the back, Matt Ryan.
Congratulations.
That said, a question that I get all the time after my human rights class. Professor Chomsky, I've heard about the realities of what's going on here, but what concretely can I, a 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old undergraduate who is just coming to these realities, what can I do here and now on the campus, in my community, something? Give some sort of a concrete example of something that young people have done that you've seen, because you travel all over the country and all over the world, and I'm sure you have many such. Thank you.
It's kind of interesting. I mean, I ended up enlisting a series of very straightforward things that can be, that people can organize about and advocate and implement, because they happen to be very conservative proposals that the majority of the population, the overwhelming majority, wants anyway. Now, there's no secret about what you do about those things. That's what, I mean, how did the Bolivian peasants manage to elect Evo Morales? You know, they don't ask, what can I do? They go ahead and do it, you know. And the same is true, and we know what we can do. If you want to know what's been achieved, there's a huge record of it. Why is this the most free country in the world? Which it is. You know, it wasn't given as a gift. I mean, it certainly wasn't true in the past. You know, the hideous record. I mean, even if you just take freedom of speech, it's a major achievement. It's a crucial human right, freedom of speech. I mean, by now, it's protected in the United States better than in any other country I know of. The U.S. Supreme Court has set standards for protection of freedom of speech that, as far as I know, are unique in the world. Is that in the Bill of Rights? No. Is it in American history? No. In fact, the issues didn't even reach the courts. I mean, they may be words somewhere, but they don't mean anything. The issues didn't reach the courts till the 20th century, and then very weakly. And in fact, a high standard for protection of freedom of speech was reached in 1964. That was in a case involving Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement. Okay, by then that was a mass popular movement. You know, limited in focus, but mass popular movement. And in that context, the court supported King and the Civil Rights Movement in a crucial case and set a high standard of protection of freedom of speech, which went beyond in the 60s as a result of activism. Well, that's standard. You run through the rights. They were won. They weren't granted. And we know how they were won, and the young people were right in the lead. I mean, just take the example of the Civil Rights Movement. Who was leading it? Well, you know, it's right to honor Martin Luther King. He was an important figure, but he would have been the first person to say that he was a follower, not a leader. I mean, the people who were leading the Civil Rights Movement were mostly students, young black students, some white ones in the South, who were right on the front lines every day, whether it was sitting in lunch counters or riding freedom buses and facing serious dangers, beaten, sometimes killed. Mostly forgotten, like most leaders. They were at the forefront of creating a movement which ultimately had major effects. By now we kind of take it for granted, but it's very recent, so look at it. I mean, probably the popular movement from the 60s, actually the 70s, that had the biggest impact on the general culture is the women's movement. Where'd that come from? I mean, like, was it a gift from the Supreme Court? You know, it came from a lot of activism, starting with small consciousness-raising groups, movements, activities, education. It just changed the whole country. I mean, in fact, a lot of the world. In this respect, there's just huge differences, not only here. I mean, I just happened to be reading an article on banana workers in the Caribbean who are miserably oppressed. But it turns out that there has been, for the first time, a women's movement among the banana workers who have brought forward women's issues. And like everywhere else, they're the most oppressed. And they've succeeded in making gains, bringing in others, beyond what the labor movements have ever achieved in the past. I mean, if we helped them, they could do even more, you know. And that's gone on all over the world, and it happened, because a lot of people were willing to go out and work day after day. I mean, we're indoctrinated, you know. In the rich, privileged societies, you're kind of indoctrinated with the notion that you have to have instant gratification. You know, I went to a demonstration and nothing happened, so what can I do? Or I push the lever in every 4 years and nothing happens, so what can I do? That's not the way it works. I mean, it works by constant engagement, hard, constant, regular work, which builds up popular movements. There's a reason why there's a huge democratic revival in the South, in South America, but not here. There's a reason why the World Social Forum regularly meets in Porto Alegre and Mumbai and Caracas and so on, not in New York and Berlin and so on. The reason is that the South is way in the lead in developing meaningful democracy and under far harsher conditions than we face, incomparably harsher conditions, with none of the opportunities that we have. I mean, we can sit and watch and say, well, what can I do about it? And the answer is everything they do magnified by 100 or 1,000 because we have so many more opportunities. And it certainly has made changes. I mean, just in the last couple of decades, there have been enormous changes on all sorts of issues. And young people are quite often, not always, but quite often in the lead. Take the global justice movements, what are ludicrously called anti-globalization movements. Called anti-globalization because they're pro-globalization for people, not profits. So it makes them anti-globalization. Did they ever exist in the past? I mean, it was unheard of until the last few years. These are mass popular movements. They're all over the place. I mean, sort of visible in the World Social Forum, but that spawned regional and local social forums all over, lots of ongoing activism, different things in different places. Young people are mostly in the forefront of that, not entirely, but mostly. That's just the last couple of years. And go back further, and there's still more. These are all things that can be done, but they are not going to be done by intermittent participation in something. They're going to be done by constant involvement, doesn't mean 100% of your time, but you're always around. You're part of an organization. It's always doing something. You help when you can. You do the kinds of things that have to be done next. They may be small things, but they add up. That's what you can do. It's the way changes come in the past. It's the way significant changes have come in the recent past. And that's the way it'll go on. There's no other magic key that anybody knows. There is, I've noticed, as you say, I travel around a lot, in fact, around the world, into all kinds of communities here, too, and in the rich countries, Liverpool's different from Oxford, and poor communities in the slums here are different from, elite universities. And I can't prove it, but there's a correlation which is so clear. It's got to have, I think it's meaningful. And the correlation is that the principle is that the more privilege, wealth, and opportunity people have, the more they feel helpless. Just think about it. I think that's very generally the case. Now, I think you can even answer the question, why? Because wealth and privilege are associated with massive indoctrination from infancy to make you feel helpless, isolated, incapable of doing anything, alone, and so on. But it's just not true. It's only true if you accept the indoctrination. So, I think there's plenty of easy answers.
Professor Chomsky, thank you very much for the very large body of your great work, and thank you so much for coming to Binghamton. If we look at the 2004 presidential race, there is, on matters of great importance, matters of war and peace, there wasn't a large amount of difference between the two major candidates. And if we look at the outcome of the election, I believe it was 49-51%. That statistically looks like a coin toss.
Yes,
in 2003, you signed a letter along with a very large number of high-profile former 2000 Ralph Nader supporters urging people, in effect, to that this election was too important to let the that the issues get in the way of things, that this election was strategic, and we basically had to vote Bush out of office. I'm wondering if you could reflect on the wisdom of that strategy.
Right. That was exactly the right position, and it was exactly the position I took for the 2000 election. Same one, exactly. And there's a good reason for it. There was no alternative. Ralph Nader's a very nice person. He's done lots of important things, but he does not make a contribution to political democracy. You do not make a contribution to political democracy by showing up every 4 years and saying, vote for me, you know, without a, in fact, what does the vote mean? Who are the senators on the ticket? Who are the governors? Who are the local representatives? You know, who's the representative for school board? I mean, a political organization is something, you know, like, I don't know, take the Brazilian Workers' Party. I mean, a million things wrong with it, but it's an actual political party, you know, which people participate. It has programs, and they're constantly working on them, and they're connected to mass popular movements, loosely connected, like the Landless Workers Movement and others. The same with the indigenous movements in Bolivia. And the same in the past when there was a level of functioning democracy here. Okay, so yeah, the choice in 2000 and in 2004 was highly restricted. The position that that letter actually took in 2004 and in 2000, same, is if you're in a safe state, you know which way it's going to go, then do what you think is right. If you think it's right to vote for Nader, vote for Nader. If you think it's right to vote green, vote green. Or if you think it's right not to bother voting at all, which you can give an argument for, do that. But do, you know, just what you think contributes best to developing some potential electoral alternative, if there ever is one. If you're in a swing state, you know, where your vote's going to matter, well, then you have a real choice. Do you want to vote for Bush? Well, okay. If you want the most reactionary and dangerous force in the world to be in power, then don't vote for Kerry. But that's your choice. There's no point dreaming. If you have failed, if we have failed to create democratic alternatives, because we didn't do the work that was required, then, you know, the day the election comes up, you can't pretend that you did it. You didn't do it. Okay, so therefore you're stuck with the choice of voting Bush in or not voting Bush in. And voting for anyone but Kerry happens to be voting Bush in. And the reason is our failure to create an alternative. And I think that was the right choice decision in 2000 and in 2004 and sometimes in the past. You know, whatever, there were some differences, and you know, they may be small differences, but in a huge system of power, a small differences can translate into huge effects on people's lives, even on human survival. So I don't see anything wrong with it.
I'm Marianne Grady Flores. I'm the sister of Claire and Teresa Grady from... Thank you. From the St. Patrick's Four, I wanted to ask you, Professor Chomsky, if you could address the issue for the need for more civil disobedience and the role that that played during the Vietnam War era, and what do we need to do today, the sacrifices that we need to make today, not only on the campuses, but as private citizens in terms of not paying for war, not pursuing jobs that are going to feed into this system.
Well, I mean, I think civil disobedience is very important. In the 60s, I was very much involved in it. So I was one of the two organizers of National tax resistance in 1965. I was very much involved in forming the major resistance support groups, resist, the ones that came to trial in 1968. I was facing a potential long prison sentence myself, called off by the Tet Offensive. It's the only reason it didn't go through. The government after that called off the trials. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but it's a tactic. It's not a principle. And tactics have to be, there's nothing, you know, tactics are really, tactical decisions are very important. You know, they are the ones that have direct human consequences. So they're really important. But they have to be understood as tactics, not as principles. And a tactic has to be judged by its likely impact. Okay? That's a tricky judgment. And I would never urge anyone to trust my judgment, which is usually very bad, and yours is probably better. But anyhow, that's how we should face the question. My own personal judgment, for what it's worth, I mean, in general, civil disobedience is a useful tactic if it gets people, it opens people's minds, it gets them to want to do something more than they're already doing. Okay, in that case, it's a good tactic. And I think that's the criterion you have to use to determine whether it's the right tactic to engage in or not. In the 60s at some stage and into the 70s, I thought it was. My own judgment now is there's other tactics that are better. I mean, we already have most of the population on our side. Okay, so I think the major problem is just simple ones, education and organizing. Overcome the atomization, you know, overcome the fact that people can't know the important things because they're kept from them. And they're kept from, I mean, you can, there's a reason for the imposed atomization. I mean, the massive consumerism is part of it. If you can get people isolated and separated from one another, they're going to be totally ineffectual. I mean, they may feel completely hopeless, but they're not going to do anything. I mean, you can't even have opinions unless you talk to other people about it. I mean, that's true in the hard sciences. You know, you go to an MIT graduate course in physics or in my own field or anything, you form your opinions about technical topics by interacting with others. You know, you don't sit somewhere by yourself and make it all up. You try them, you see how people react, you know, you get some ideas, you know, you change them and so on. If people are, I mean, that was the enormous importance of unions and the reason why there's such a huge attack against unions. Unions are a democratizing force. They bring people together, and they enable them jointly to do things that none of them can do individually. You know, they're not General Electric. In fact, for the rich, there are plenty of associations. They don't atomize each other. You know, they got all kinds of associations, Business Roundtable, a million others. But they want everybody else to be isolated and separated. That's natural, a typical relation between power centers and victims. And it seems to me the major problem is overcoming that. And I'm not sure that civil disobedience is the way to overcome that. Maybe. You've got to make your own judgment. But if it is, it's only if it's supported by other efforts. The efforts to use the civil disobedience as an educational and organizing tool. And then at some point, maybe the civil disobedience does contribute to it. But, you know, without expressing a judgment, because my judgments don't mean anything, and you got to make your own. It seems to me at least those are the criteria we should have in mind. And I think the fundamental problems that face the society now are a huge democratic deficit which can be overcome. It's been overcome in the past. It's done in other countries in much harder conditions than ours. There's no reason why we can't do it. However, there is a reason why I'm afraid I have to stop. I was given an order that we're supposed to end at 9 o'clock.
Professor Noam Chomsky speaking on March 4th in Binghamton, New York. Thanks to Herbert Bix and Steve Macklin for their assistance and cooperation. You can download an MP3 or podcast of this and prior programs at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Yeah.